This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. Good evening. The title of tonight's installment is Identity Politics. And I'm picking up exactly where I left off the last time, citing an article, a Wikipedia article called Identity Politics. I think it illustrates a point that I want to make as in this installment as a whole about the pretty dishonest way in which identity politics and identity in general is exists in modern contemporary political discourse and in our society. It's a shell game, or I can't really think of a good term for it, but it's as I said last time, the reality underneath is who, whom, group-based struggle, conflict, warfare, and it's veiled in a dishonest language that tries to cover up the fact that that's what it's about. So the prime example of this is, and I stumbled on this just by chance in trying to look up identity and see what other people had to say about it, is this article about identity politics, which starts out by describing it as groups of people and political arguments made by those groups of people that are shaped by the identities of the groups, are shaped by aspects of their identity through race, class, religion, gender, sexual orientation. In other words, in a very general description that could easily fit white people, until you read the rest of the article and find out that white people aren't included in the list of valid identities. You know, where white is not a considered a valid identity. In fact, many of the identities in identity politics and the identity politics as a whole are anti-white in their essence. This, you know, the reality is here, even if that weren't the case, the reality is that in a multiracial society, all politics are identity politics. You have the different groups would be struggling against each other. And it's really only in a homogenous state, a homogenous nation of people who had settled the who is us question that could move beyond all the ethnic squabbling, the intergroup squabbling, and have a coherent, productive debate about the fundamental questions about what's best for us, what should we do, what should our policies be. When you have multiple races squabbling and fighting for resources and power, they can't even really come to an agreement on who us is. And in today's reality, what we have is a dishonest situation where white people, I've said this before, are told that it's our responsibility to provide a safe society for everyone. We're not allowed to have a them. Everyone is us, is how we're encouraged to think about it. And meanwhile, blacks organize for black best interests, and Latinos organize for Latino best interests, and Jews and Asians and gays and women and, you know, every imaginable way in which people could identify as a group, they're busy organizing to pursue their best interests as a group, but not whites. So I've mentioned before also this good faith, bad faith, the sort of measure of a situation as to when you are debating or arguing politics with someone, and this dishonest nature of our current political discourse is demonstrated by the bad faith. It demonstrates bad faith that it is dishonest like this. They don't say to us, "Well, yeah, I'm black, you're white, you know, you have your white identity, and that's okay, and let's argue, let's divvy up the resources." And actually, you know, I say black and white because it's the strongest contrast that comes to mind. But to be fair, in my encounters with the blacks, I haven't had much problems with blacks telling me that I'm imagining things, that I have a white identity or that I have interests as a white person. They take that as a given, and it's only really Jews and other white people who try to make this argument that, you know, who is white, you know. It's all so confusing, which is dishonest. It's disingenuous. So the article goes on to describe the Marxist origins of identity politics, and it traces them, the term itself, to the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s, and black nationalism and black feminism in particular, where the phrase identity politics first came from. Despite its Marxist origins, and I touched on this the last time, that amongst right-thinking people, conservatives, identity politics is something distasteful to them. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They think it's bad. It's what the other side does. And part of it is this Marxist origins to it. But you know, the point I tried to make the last time, and I'll make this time, and I'll continue to make. Is in asserting a white identity and speaking in favor of white identity, is that whites have a right and a duty and a natural tendency to want to identify as a group, big and small, in a broad white sense and in a narrow white sense. And I'll talk more about that as I get into white identity specifically. But we shouldn't be frightened away from thinking about identity, that it's that one of the reasons that we shouldn't think about it is because that's what the enemy uses. It works for them. It can work for us too. And it has worked for us in the past. And we've been convinced to abandon it, and that was wrong. It was a mistake. The Wikipedia article about identity politics goes on to say that the term identity politics has been applied retroactively. Now, they're talking here about how, even though the term only appeared in the 60s and 70s, that the concept goes back farther than that. It has been applied retroactively to varying movements that long predate its coinage. Historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. discussed identity politics extensively in his book, The Disuniting of America. Schlesinger, a strong supporter of liberal conceptions of civil rights, argues that a liberal democracy requires a common basis for culture and society to function. In his view, basing politics on group marginalization fractures the civil polity and therefore works against creating real opportunities for ending marginalization. Schlesinger believes that movements for civil rights should aim towards full acceptance and integration of marginalized groups into the mainstream culture rather than perpetuating that marginalization through affirmations of difference. Well, that all sounds very nice, and you might even find a thing or two there to agree with, but I would say this is part of the dishonesty. When he was writing this stuff, it was decades ago, and even though he died recently, it's not what I want, and it's not what white people should want. It's part of what I said here. It's encouraging white people to maintain a civil polity. You know, it's our responsibility to provide a society for all of these other quote unquote marginalized groups to thrive in, to exist in and thrive in at our expense. And of course he's in favor of that. His background, cited by the article, the Wikipedia article on Schlesinger, is that his father's father was Jewish. So that would make him one quarter Jewish. He looks very Jewish in his face. And, you know, he basically is arguing in favor of acceptance and integration because he's a product of it himself. So he sees that as a working model. He's a, you know, an example of Jews integrating into white society. And so he wants to encourage more of that. And I would say it's failed. It's failing. The rhetoric that this Wikipedia article is—it's not his words, Schlesinger's words in particular, but necessarily they're not quoting him here. They're just giving an overview of it in today's terms. But today we can see that it's false. It's the white people who used to define mainstream culture in America aren't disuniting. You know, it's not something we're doing voluntarily to ourselves. This is, you know, it's not suicide. We're being replaced. We're being erased, dismantled, displaced, dispossessed. All of those words are more accurate than disuniting. It's being orchestrated. It's organized by a hostile elite. And these people are supposedly a marginalized group. You know, the Jews in this hostile elite portray themselves as a marginalized group, and yet they're on top of the heap, and they're the ones shaping policy, politics, including identity politics, and the fact that whites are not supposed to participate in identity politics. It's white people who get marginalized by this supposedly marginalized group. If uppity whites get uppity and speak against them and speak against these alien hostile people who rule over us, then we're the ones who are marginalized. We see this in the political discourse. It's pretty clear. You know, the talk about Obama describing unemployed factory workers in Pennsylvania as clinging to their guns and Bible in a very disdainful attitude to an audience of rich, wealthy Democrat funders, contributors, and how the media, the Jewish media, Jewish liberal media, describes the farmers in living in flyover country very dismissively and denigrates them, and the impoverished rednecks and hillbillies, you know, those racists who live mostly down south. These people are all poor. These are the natural constituency of the Democrats, supposedly, or the historic constituency of the left. But today they find themselves more and more left with nowhere to go except maybe the Republican Party, and only because the Republican Party is becoming more and more the white party for which it's criticized constantly by the Jewish media, Jews in the media, and blacks in the media. The identity politics article goes on after the Schlesinger bit. Still other critics have argued that groups based on shared identity other than class, for example, religious identity or neurological wiring, can divert energy and attention from more fundamental issues, such as class conflict in capitalist societies. Even those who support gay rights, ending racism, or freedom of religion, for instance, may consider them to be side issues at best. And this is kind of awkwardly written. It's basically making the point that the only group identity that's really important to the person who wrote this paragraph is the ones based on class conflict. That's the fundamental issue, class conflict. And that's just a pure Marxism, economic Marxism. There is this pretense that race doesn't matter, religion doesn't matter so much. It's class, it's economic class that drives everything, and the other stuff pales in comparison. And that's just false. At the very least, they're all involved. Race and religion and class are all involved in identity and involved in the conflicts that arise. And personally, I've made the argument, and I stick to it, that the race is actually the fundamental division and the fundamental issue, and that a lot of this Marxist and cultural Marxist rhetoric about identity is really just they're waving their hands that, hey, you white people, you're not supposed to have a racial identity. That's bad. That's bad. While you're describing identity politics being all about blacks and Latinos and Jews and Asians and all the rest having their identity and having their organizing for their best interests. The Humpty Dumpties don't consider race to be a valid identity, or at least for white people, as they allude to here. You know, they are interested in ending racism, which is really just a dishonest way of saying they want to end white people. They want to end whiteism. Ending racism means ending whiteism. They're not talking about ending identity politics, which is racist. You know, it's based on race, at least in part. They're really just talking about ending white identity, which is racism, quote unquote racism in their mind, in their descriptions of it. The Wikipedia article goes on. Eric Hobsbawm, in particular, has criticized nationalisms. This is about you know, the danger to seeing the whole thing as class conflict. Now, he's criticized nationalisms and the principle of national self-determination adopted internationally after World War I. Since national governments are often merely an expression of a ruling class or power, and their proliferation was a source of wars of the wars of the 20th century. Hence, Hobsbawm argues that identity politics such as queer nationalism, Islamism, Cornish nationalism, or Ulster loyalism are just other versions of bourgeois nationalism. Now, this is a continuation of the Marxist terminology and the Marxist way of the pure Marxist way of seeing things. It's saying even these other group identities of queers and Muslims and so forth is less valid than the real deal, which is economic class divisions. And it's coming from this guy named Eric Hobsbawm. So I was curious about him and clicked to find out who this guy is. And his Wikipedia page says about him, Hobsbawm was born in 1917 in Alexandria, Egypt, to Leopold Percy Obstbaum and Nellie Grün, both Jewish, and he grew up in Vienna, Austria, and Berlin, Germany. So here's a cosmopolitan citizen of the world, and he's a Marxist, and doesn't think that race is important at all. he's got, you know, his Jewish identity, and they don't comment on, you know, how his Jewish identity has shaped his life, but this is one expression of it, I guess, is criticizing other people's nationalisms. I'm sure he would be very offended if someone were to criticize, well, he's dead now, but I think, if somebody criticized Jewish nationalism, he would probably join 99.9% of other Jews in condemning that as an attack on all Jews. Because it is, I guess. And just like I think that this dishonest, disingenuous attack on nationalism and racism, quote-unquote racism, is really an attack on white people. That's the only thing that they really pathologize and demonize is white people doing that, having that kind of an identity. I want to point out here, bourgeois is sort of a highfalutin Marxist term. It just means middle class, social or economic middle class. And especially in today's the United States, the middle class is really just a code word for white people, because it's mostly white people in the middle class. Reactionary was another word that came up there in that paragraph. That's another Marxist code word. You know, it's human nature for people to not want to be ruled by other people. That's sort of the idea behind self-determination for nationalities or really any division, any level of division that people want to have. is the idea that you don't want to be ruled by someone who's alien, who doesn't share your values, doesn't share your identity. And it's a perfectly normal and natural. It's, I think, common to all human beings in some shape or form. And Hobsbawm, though, has this kind of mysterious opposition to the ruling class that he thinks is misleading us all. And yet he doesn't support self-determination, this idea of self-determination, which would be, you know, in opposition to a ruling class, at least an alien ruling class. But you see, this is where I think his Jewish identity comes into it, is he probably realized at some part of his brain that the in the West, at least, the ruling class is largely Jewish. It's disproportionately Jewish in most Western countries, and certainly amongst the thought leaders. And if we were to have self-determination for white people, for white Westerners, that would mean an awful lot of Jews out of work, out of a job, out of leading society and telling us what to do. You know, and this guy Hobsbawm, he's not in government, but here he is. He's trying to shape our thoughts. He's telling us nationalism is wrong. It's bad. So bourgeois nationalism, I was curious about that, so I looked that up, and what is that exactly? Bourgeois nationalism is a term for Marxist phraseology. It refers to the alleged practice by the ruling classes of deliberately dividing people by nationality, race, ethnicity, or religion, so as to distract them from possible class warfare. Well, I think that description is there to distract us from the divisions, the natural divisions by nationality, race, ethnicity, and religion. That's what the class warfare rhetoric is all about. This is an inversion of reality, one of many I've pointed out. And that's what this guy is talking about when he talks about bourgeois nationalism. Oh, that's not right. That's bad. It's unreal. Reading this stuff. It is seen, it goes on, there's more. It is seen as a divide and conquer strategy used by the ruling classes to prevent the working class from uniting against them. That's exactly what this is. It's a divide and conquer strategy to keep people of a single nationality, race, or ethnicity, or religion even, from uniting to oppose the ruling classes. very good, Hobsbawm. It's just you got it exactly wrong, and I think that was exactly on purpose. He's one of these Humpty Dumpties, defining words and telling us what words like nationalism mean. You know, queer nationalism. Jeez, that's strange. I looked that one up too, but I don't even want to discuss that. It just makes me ill. A question here. You know, who are the ruling classes today? I mentioned it a bit. I already said who I think it is. You know, but just think about it objectively. Who rules as a class? And I would include with this the chattering classes, the who sort of hector and harangue the supposed ruling classes. You know, when we think of ruling class, we think of the elected leadership. But do they really rule, or are they just figureheads, really? And do they really have more of a say of what happens in society and in politics and in national policy, foreign policy and domestic policy, than the chattering classes, the people who write editorials for the major newspapers or get on the talking heads who get on the pundits? I'm not talking necessarily about news deliverers, but the critics, the opinionators, the pundits who get on TV and criticize mercilessly the politicians who are supposedly the leaders. And, I think it's obvious from who can't be criticized as a group, and that is Jews. It's not whites running our society by a very simple measure that you can criticize whites until you're blue in the face. You could say the nastiest things you want about white people as a group or as individuals and as whites. Specifically because they're white, and nobody goes to jail for that. Nobody gets fired from their jobs for that. Nobody gets boycotted for that. But you get all of that punishment and more if you have any criticism for Jews. It's whites who are targeted by this divide and conquer strategy. I think Hobsbawm was projecting there. So I'm going to move on now away from Wikipedia. Not that I think Wikipedia is necessarily bad for this kind of subject matter. It might be bad for getting opinions about objective views about whites white people, white racial matters. But on matters of cultural Marxism, I think that they represent the thinking pretty well. But let me move to a more original source and a more authoritative source directly found by Searching for Identity Politics, and that is a page coming from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So you would think just from the name Stanford and that it's an encyclopedia of philosophy that this must be a really high quality source. And in it's a long piece, but embedded in it, and the part I'm going to focus on here, is liberalism and identity politics, because I think it highlights the thing I've talked about before, this business about white people being expected to maintain the society while these other identities, these other groups, maintain their own independent identity and pursue their own interests. So it starts off saying, critics charged that the neutral citizen of liberal theory was in fact the bearer of an identity, coded white, male, bourgeois, able-bodied, and heterosexual. This implicit ontology is part explained in part explained the persistent historical failure of liberal democracies to achieve anything more than token inclusion in power structures for members of marginalized groups. There's that phrase Hobsbawm was using about marginalized groups. And what this paragraph is laying out here is a critique of this liberal society. It's not good enough for them that whites have tried to create a society where everyone is equal. We're still oppressing these marginalized groups. This paragraph identifies who the oppressors are. It's white, male, bourgeois, able-bodied, and heterosexual. This is who is excluded or forbidden from identity politics. That's the point I wanted to make about that paragraph. It goes on, a richer understanding of political subjects. Well, it looks like I'm about out of time. I want to say that, skipping down here, that this is a critique of assimilation. It describes liberalism as being all about assimilation. The idea is basically that in the past, whites were not inclusive enough, and that was oppression. Today, whites are too inclusive, and that's oppression. And the one constant here is that whites are oppressors. The central guiding principle of today's social political zeitgeist is that whites are bad, non-whites are good. Liberal democracy is best characterized by the endless making of excuses for non-whites and blaming white people for all their problems. The roots of it are in the emancipations of Jews in Europe some 200 years ago. That's where all this oppression rhetoric and the oppression narrative comes from. So I hope this makes sense to you, and I'll see you next time.